Adversity? Bring it. The struggle? I welcome it. Snooze on life? Never that. I am Dave Regina, and this is the No Snooze Podcast. Come on. Welcome back, No Snooze Podcast, episode 166. As always, I'm in the booth with a new three. We have Vincent, the entrepreneur, Maselli, Claudio, the voice, Valenzuela, and I am Dave, the body, Regina. Vincent Maselli founded Verb in 2018 and has served as a CEO since its inception. He defined the vision and strategy, and is leading the company through multiple phases of rapid growth. Verb is on a mission to empower fitness brands to scale and amplify human communication. Today, companies are using Verb to improve conversion, retention, and client happiness. The first tool that automates messaging and leverages AI-powered insights. Vin earned his BA in business and finance from Sacred Heart University. With stints on Wall Street, Vin is a serial entrepreneur and the founder and owner for Body Blueprint Gym. Vin has also owned and operated very successful nightclubs in New York City, has helped investors invest into approximately 30 startups, has owned liquor companies, and has also lost 100 pounds, not once, but twice. Vin, welcome to the podcast, my brother.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, and I'm excited to dig into it today.
Yeah, man. And shout out to Jason Lacayo for the introduction here.
Yes.
So full disclosure, we met one time on Zoom with Sean Degnan too.
Yep.
Great conversation. Wanted to further this, but I don't know if I've ever seen a bio like this, man. You know, it's funny, like when we were texting back and forth, I'm like, send me something. He goes, you know, like this, and he puts this like little paragraph with like just some points together, and my mind was blown from the start. So how does it feel when somebody reads that back, though?
It feels really good to hear it. I feel like my journey has typically been, you know, had its ups and downs, and I think that the way in which I attack projects or chapters in my life, it gets reflected in the things that I've done and the experiences that I've had, which is like a lot of people say very successful people are good at saying no. And for a big portion of my career, I just wanted to experience as much as I could. I wanted to learn as much as I could. I wanted to be in as many rooms as I could. And I said yes to a lot. And that allowed me to travel the world. It allowed me to be involved in multi-sector businesses. Like you said, I've had liquor brands, I've had gyms, I've had nightclubs, I've been on Wall Street. I've seen a lot of different types of businesses and how they were run. So I've been really fortunate to be around amazing people. It's really been an exciting thing to see so many people try to start companies, start their side hustle, you know, whatever it is that drives them. And that's been the most fun for me, is that I've just been able to meet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of amazing human beings.
Incredible, man. So to me, a CEO, right, runs numbers, understands impact, understands what it takes to move the needle closer to the goal. At one point, or 2 points, I guess, in your life, you were not happy with yourself because you lost 100 pounds, again, not just once, but twice. And if you're looking at it on YouTube, I mean, this is an incredible journey. And I have to start there because, to me, all the other stuff is cool. But somebody who's extremely successful, I believe, has the ability to not only accomplish their goals in business, but also from a health and wellness standpoint. Yep. So talk to me about how the hell did you get there?
Yeah, so my overall fitness journey in my life has been a unique one. My dad lifted weights his whole life. We were, you know, from a young age, 8, 9 years old, learning how to put a piece of wood under our feet to deadlift. And I mean, my dad had like a old school bodybuilding gym in our house. So we were around weights our whole life. It was always really important to him, and it was always really important to us. And my family, you know, we're not big guys. I'm 5'7" on my best day. And walked around 130 pounds most of my life. gained some weight, you know, when puberty hit and we learned that there were some extracurricular activities. You know, it's now really okay and not taboo to be on TRT, but in 1999, you know, you got a cycle from somebody and gained 20 pounds as a 15 or 16 year old, right? Yeah. Like that was kind of like what went on in my high school. So anyway, was always around it, two sport athlete, you know, generally was just in shape, you know, middle sized guy, like nothing special. College, I ran my first company and I worked full time, ran my first company, took a full course load. And my company was, we scheduled parties around the state of Connecticut. So, you know, mostly from 2002 to 2006, like if you were out in Stamford or Norwalk or New Haven or Fairfield, like I probably was involved in one of those nights,
right, in
one way or another. And that led to obviously not great lifestyle, right? I'm out drinking every night. I'm out, you know, I'm living college life, trying to go to the gym as well. But like, you know, that all catches up. So when I graduated college, I was about 55 pounds, right? I was pretty big.
It's heavy, dude.
And that was the first time I was like, okay, so this does not look well on me. Like I got to get back in shape. So that was the first time that I did it. I was young. That was kind of easy to do.
What'd you do though? Like what was the structure of this?
Looking back then, I was working out in my home gym, which is at, you know, was my parents' home gym, doing a decent amount of running. And that time, like weighing food wasn't a thing. I think I was just like a chicken breast and a cup of rice in a tub of
broccoli,
right? Like like really basic chicken breast, rice, a vegetable in a Tupperware. That's what I ate. And like, I think it was like 3 egg whites, 2 eggs scrambled with some bacon and toast. Like that was, I ate it every day. And yeah, it kind of came off. Nothing too specific around training, just a old school bodybuilding split, 60 minutes cardio, whatever. And what I found, and if you're listening to this and you're struggling with weight loss, if you get to a target weight or if you go through that struggle to lose a certain amount of weight, you probably buy yourself 2 or 3 good years of like being lenient. And that's what I found both times that happened. Like right. I bought myself a ton of time of enjoying life again. And then like it cut back up. So first time I did it, I was probably 22, 23. It helped that I was going onto Wall Street and working 16 hour days, cold calling. Like there wasn't time for nonsense in my life. So that was easy as well. Like, yeah, you know, go to the gym in the morning, go to work, I'm home, I go to sleep. Like there was no extracurricular activities. And then the second time it was right around when my nightclubs were imploding. So I owned nightclubs for a number of years from 08 to about 11 or 12.
Which clubs?
Juliet Supper Club and Greenhouse and Whip were the properties. So they were a portfolio of brands and we were lead investors in them and partners and did some financing for different parts of the projects. And as those were kind of imploding, I was like 267. And I was watching all my money evaporate and my relationship was falling apart. Like there was nothing good going on. I had a drug problem and alcohol problem. I mean, I had everything not great going on. And that time I was a little bit older. I was probably, that's like 2011 I started, right? So April, like, I think it was like April 7th, 2011, I stopped drinking and drugs and I was like, oh, I'm going to try to lose weight. And the first thing that I did is I was like, oh, cool. I'll just stop doing drugs and smoking and drinking. Those are the 3 things that I can actually control. And let's see what happens. And I lost 100 pounds in 1 year to the day. Actually, I went down to like 157. So maybe a little bit more than 100. And that time, I didn't know what CrossFit was or I didn't know what functional fitness was. But I was doing a bodybuilding split. And in between, I was like doing jumping jacks. Like in between my sets instead of rest, I was doing jumping jacks. And like, you know, knee ups and just movements.
Yep.
I was like, just keep moving. And then same thing, like 60 minutes cardio, walking, or like 20 minutes sprinting. That was all that I did.
Let me cut you off there. So I think for people tend to get like bored of this, right? Where you're saying, I just kept moving. And that's the most powerful thing you can do, right? Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to somebody who kind of gets bored in those, you know, I guess, moments. But you know, at the end of the day, that that's what you have to keep doing.
Yeah, it's a, right? Really, it's a, tough, it's a really good question. So this is going to be a kind of a loaded statement because I work out all the time, right? I'm currently training for an ultra, and which is a ton of time under tension, right? I don't really love working out. Like, I don't know if you've ever been on a couch eating pizza. Like, that's way better, right? Like,
yeah.
But so to answer your question about being bored, it's boring. It just is. But the idea now and like Instagram and social media has like given us this idea that like a lot of weightlifting and bodybuilding and being in shape is like this flashy thing. And it's really just doing the work, like doing the hard work when no one's watching repetitively. So to answer your question, the thing that drove my weight loss both times, and I really stick by this, I talked to a lot of clients, I've coached thousands and thousands of clients over the past decade, was vanity for me. I didn't find myself attractive. I didn't feel like I added visual value to anyone. So like the idea of a six pack was what drove me to get in shape, and then then being healthy followed, right? So when I don't want to walk up, you know, incline 10 on 3.5 for 60 minutes when I was overweight, the thing that drove me through that boredom and misery was that I was gross to myself, right? And that was finding the thing that was more important than the reason not to. And again, it's like really a cliche thing to say, because you hear all these people like, oh, find a yes that's bigger than your no, and like it'll be great. It's shitty and it sucks, and nobody wants to eat plain grilled chicken and rice when you're used to eating pizza and nachos. And the boring part is you can find some version of fitness that is less boring than the version of fitness you think will do it. Mm. Right. And look, I've been in the fitness business now for, I don't know, 12 or 13 years. And I tell people all the time, I'm like, my type of fitness doesn't need to be the fitness that works for you. It doesn't matter if it's CrossFit or SoulCycle or Pilates or bodybuilding or running, whatever it is that you're comfortable doing for 45 minutes to an hour a day, that's good enough to get you to where you want to be. Like, just do that.
Right.
I would say it's a very important part of the journey of being healthy or being in shape or being happy with your body. It is not the most important part. It's all the other little things that happen. Yep. And that's really the hard part of the journey. Anyone could go suffer for 30 minutes. You could like dig in and go 3-4 days a week and make it work. And it's the glasses of wine and it's the dinner with your kids or your friends. Like, that's all the stuff that is actually counteracting it. So when I think about how I fight the boredom, and you know, I run, I don't know, a couple hours, a couple times a week. And I usually run with nothing. Right.
No, so like, no, like noise.
I only do one of three options. And this will probably start a different conversation. I either listen to like Joe Rogan podcast or the most boring financial podcast I could find. Right. Taylor Swift or nothing. And I know that makes no sense. And I found that those three things just keep me even. Like, I could listen to a podcast of a topic I'd never read a book for. And I might not listen to the whole thing, but like, I'll pick up pieces of it.
Right.
Joe Rogan, because they're really long and like, I don't have to worry about changing it. And like Taylor Swift, because like, it's kind of corny, but you also kind of know almost, you know, a lot of her stuff. So right. Like, it just like puts me into autopilot or silence. Right. And those three things for me, those actually, you know, it's quoting a David Goggins quote, like calluses the mind for me. Mm-hmm. Where I'm just like, yeah, this is, I could turn on something that like really fires me up, but if I could do it this way, then I can definitely do it when I have all the things in my favor.
So for people, I guess, just to give them context of what an ultra is, it's 100 miles, right?
Yeah.
Is that that's a 100-mile marathon?
Yeah. So it could be a couple different things. So people say ultra, it could be like a 50 miler. It could be 125 miles. It's all different versions of that. And, you know, it's considered an ultra marathon. It's I think it's anything more than 50 miles.
Yeah.
And for me, that is a goal that I want to achieve next year, mostly because I don't love running fast. Right. I have buddies that want to PR their marathons or PR their half marathons. And like that is a type of pain I don't want to enjoy. Whereas right. like for me, running for 18 hours is like a slow burn type of pain. It just resonates with my, yep. my masochism a little better, mm-hmm. I guess.
I got to know what were you like as a child? And then like, what was the start of the entrepreneurial journey for you? And then has it become almost an addiction to where you're like starting, you know, because I've never seen so many different forms of business here. Is it almost like you accomplish something and you're like, okay, I need to move on to the next journey? And I guess tying that back to your childhood, were there like personality traits that I guess looking back, you'd be like, all right, yeah, this makes sense.
So I'll start with my childhood and then we'll kind of yep. scale up. So as a child, I would get up at like 4 a.m. and go watch like cartoons before everyone woke up. And to me, I was just like, I wanted to watch X-Men or whatever the cartoon was, right? And my parents would come down and I would already be sleeping on the couch. I would have like a nap in the morning before people woke up. And I never thought that that was weird. I never thought that that was like a character trait. And my older brother loved to sleep. He could like sleep all day. And as I've gone through my gym business, I had fortunate to be around a lot of couples that had young children and coach children. And you could see traits in kids. And I asked my parents all the time. And I said, like, did you notice that we were all different, right? There were four of us. I was getting up at 4 to watch TV. My older brother would sleep. My younger brother was like kind of quiet and like really neat. I was the opposite of that. And my parents were like, there were four of you. Like, we were just trying to figure it out, right? Like, we didn't have time to be like, oh, my God. Like,
let's think about this. Yeah.
Yeah, you're getting up at 4 a.m. Like, that means something. Like, we should lean into that, right? So as a kid, I was like, my uncle refers to me as like a top. I would just be like, and then sleep. And up, and then sleep. And it's kind of the way that I am now. Like, I'm going. And like, when I'm on empty, I'm on empty. So that was kind of my personality my whole life. There was, you know, they used to have a joke as a soccer player. Like, I wasn't the most technical guy, but like, there was never a game that I wasn't completely covered in mud. I was just like
running all over the
place. They used to joke that the opponents could hear me coming because of my breathing. I was like a locomotive, like just barreling down the field. So it's kind of like how I've done a lot of the things in my life, which is just this like, like maniac approach to it. I always worked, right? So probably from like 14, you know, I worked at like, I think 13 or 14, I got my first job. And, you know, actually before that, I was like a camp counselor at like my baseball camp. So maybe at 10, 11, I started being a counselor. 12, I started like, you know, so I guess as long as I could remember, I was kind of like doing things that mm-hmm. generated either work or free something, right? And then in college was when I started my first company, right? And we started this events business and it was wildly successful. I mean, I was making more money than I knew what to do with. We would like go in and, you know, tell a restaurant or a bar like, hey, like we'll staff the night. We'll be responsible for the revenue. Either we could get the door or we get 25% of the bar or a combination of it. And me and my partner, we were probably making like, I don't know, 5 or 10 grand each in cash a week as like 18, 19 year olds. And then I worked full time. So I would put all my class schedules on a Monday and I would go to school 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday. If you were a business major, you could take once a week classes.
Yep.
And then I would go to work full time Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at a mutual fund company and then work at the bars and clubs at night. So that was like really the first time that I noticed that my interest in work was different. My interest in like being around business was different.
Did you like money specifically?
Yes. So I knew that I wanted to be more successful than what I deemed to be successful, right? I knew that to create real generational or lineage wealth, someone had to sacrifice their life for that. And I, early on in my life, was like, I want that person to be me. I want to be like the guy in my family tree that they were like, yeah, he did it. He's like,
he's the one.
He's the one that did it. And so it was always like a grind for me. It was always like, I want to be around business. I want to learn as much as I can. I want to be around people who have made money, have lost money, like run different types of things. So that was really my first big kind of stint in that. And I just always wanted to work. Like corporate America was easy for me. I could have easily stayed mm-hmm. at the investment bank that I went and worked at after college and like worked my way up. They wanted to put me, you know, on a management track. When you manage money, you're either like on the sales side or the management side. Like those are like the two tracks. And they wanted to put me into the management track, which ultimately meant that I would, you know, then become a manager of, let's say, an investment arm of the business, and then move your way up maybe to executive level on the management side. And they wanted me to put through that. So I knew that I could do that if I always wanted to. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, starting companies sounds way better. The reason that I've kind of had so many different lives in my professional career is I'm not great at a lot of things. I think that I'm good at having exciting conversations. I'm really good at identifying things kind of before they're really cool. And maybe I'm too early or maybe I don't, you know, do it in the right way. But, and I'm not great at running like huge businesses, at least not yet in my career. So typically when something's got like the legs, I'm like, all right, well, let's bring some adults into the room and let's see what else is going on. So my biggest excitement and interest is always like when it's on a napkin and it's an idea and no one really knows what the fuck is going on. And like, we're all doing everything. And so I think that's why I've been around a lot of that life cycle of business. Mm-hmm. And it's been fortunate for me that I've been around those types of people. Mm.
Talk to me a little bit about, and this is going to, we're going to switch back and forth here, but imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And then lead me into losing it all in 2012.
Yep. So my dear friend and business partner, Brian Mazza, puts on these summits called HPLT, High Performance Lifestyle Training. And, you know, this will be my shameless plug. We're getting ready to open a gym in January in Pelham, which we're super excited about. The reason I bring that up is at one of his summits, we did this breath work, which if you've never done breath work, I was completely skeptical. I thought it was like voodoo. And it's life. It was a life-changing experience. And it was done by this absolutely amazing human, Francesca, who owns a company named Mastery. And the reason I bring that up is the most recent session that we did, it helped me to realize my battle with imposter syndrome, which is that I've always felt like I've never was supposed to be in any room, whether it's on the soccer team or on the baseball team or when I was in university or at my first company or when I was at an investment bank, you know.
And you realized that you felt that back then, even like on the soccer field?
Yeah. So really, like looking really back through this breathwork journey, gotcha. I was like, holy shit, like I'm starting striker and I'm like, I'm not even really good enough to be starting striker. Or like I walked onto my university baseball team. Like I didn't play because I was like, oh, fourth string, second baseman. Like I might as well go make money. Right. But it's like all these things. I just always looked back at these feelings and I was like, oh, I felt this forever, that like I was doing things I was not supposed to be doing. And what I've learned is nobody actually knows any, like nobody, we're all just swimming in this river, unknown and self-conscious and winging it as we go. And when I view it that way, it's almost like the, you know, if you're up public speaking, view everyone in their underwear sort of thing. But like, when I think about it, that everyone else goes home and they put their pants on the same way and they go to the bathroom the same way. And like, they all have their own levels of insecurity and also have no clue what's going on. Then you're like, well, I guess everyone's just kind of an imposter, just figuring it out.
Yep.
And that's how kind of how I deal with it. I don't know if I'll ever not feel like I'm reaching. I really like being the least important person in a place. It one means that I could learn something, and two probably means that I could, like, if I wanted to, I could fade away. If I wanted to control the room, then I could open my mouth and try to, like, do that. But the idea of imposter syndrome for me is definitely a real thing, mostly because I start companies in industries I've never been in. I mean, I had never trained a single human being until the day I opened my gym. The first time I ever actually trained a person in person was the first CrossFit class that I ever ran when I opened my gym, which, you want to talk about imposter syndrome, I'm convincing a class of 15 people that, like, I'm the guy to keep them safe. And I'm just like, how the fuck do I fit this in an hour? And, like, you know, so it, when you think about imposter syndrome and how it might affect you, it's just like everyone else is fighting the same battle.
It's a lot, man. And now, like, okay, so from there, you end up, you were on this incredible track and you ran so many companies. But then what was the moment that, I guess, because when I'm looking at the timeline, it's not the financial crisis back in, like, 2008, 2009. How'd you lose it all in 2012?
So when we had our hospitality properties, they were wildly successful. If you were going out in New York City around that time, it was still when, like, the models and bottles scene was good. And, you know, you almost look back now, I feel like New York City is kind of frozen in 2011. Like, if you were around in 2011 and you were a really successful business, you've made it, which prior to now, that was not a thing. It was like every 3-4 years, you kind of got to rebrand yourself. Things are hot, then things aren't. And we had some internal partner issues that led to some friction, which gave me, like, a PhD in how to run companies internally and corporate structure and governance and how to unwind, you know, businesses and legal dispute. Like, I mean, I really got my money's worth, let's say, in that lesson. And the thing that ultimately drove me to bankruptcy was most of those properties had guarantees that became mine, or, you know, I had been all in with all of my money already. I had made this bet that, like, we were going to have these nightclubs and they were going to be wildly successful. So I was all in on all my wealth already. And then as those companies imploded, we had a murder in one of them. And one of them, you know, I don't know how old your listeners are, but there was this pretty big kind of famous fight between Drake and Chris Brown in a nightclub. And that was one of them. And they destroyed the whole place. And so, like, all
that was
these,
in your nightclub.
Yeah. That was in one of my properties where, like, and I mean, legitimately every single thing was destroyed. It was like a, I don't know, 100+ person brawl. And so all these things were happening all at once. And it was kind of like when things go wrong, they go wrong hard. Right. And all our properties were dealing with issues and we had some partner issues. And I was just like, yeah, this is, I'm out, right? I'm already worthless. I already know that I'm going to be driven to bankruptcy. Like, it was, the writing was on the wall. And so I lost all that. I was fortunate that during the time that I owned my nightclubs, people started coming to me and were like, hey, I have this really cool idea, but I have no money. And then there were people spending money in nightclubs that didn't know shit about how to start companies. So I was doing what I called placing the other side of the trade. And I was like, that's how I got really involved in helping people start their companies and financings and putting together syndicates, which, if you don't know what that is, a syndicate is a group of people who pool their money and then invest in a business. So I'd be like, oh, like, you know, so-and-so wants to start this hat company. He needs 100 grand, like, throw in 10 grand. I'll run all the paperwork. And then I'll write that check. I'll do, you know, any mentoring, and then I'll report back to you guys.
This is all through like personal relationships that you've built over the years.
Yeah. So people ask me all the time if I would ever open nightclubs or restaurants again. And it's like 95% no, except everybody wants to be around someone who owns a nightclub or a restaurant. So there was, like, a lot of power in that relationship.
Right.
And the other thing that I've learned is favors that get paid in vices last pretty long. So, and what I mean by that is, say you can't get into a restaurant that's opening, it's a 6-month wait list, and I can get you to the opening night for your anniversary with your wife. That goes way further than, like, me helping you make some money.
Gotcha.
So I was able to leverage, once I knew my clubs were imploding, I was able to leverage that type of relationship and build a lot of really good relationships. So those all imploded, and I was completely broke. You know, imagine being an owner of a, you know, multi-million dollar hospitality brand, and then moving back in with your parents in your high school bedroom when you were 28.
So like, you were only 28 at this time.
Yeah. So that was a big, you know, and then they were like, it was an odd time, you know, like 80% of my phone, the numbers were worthless in them. People don't, you know, that's a real thing. Mm-hmm. That like, it just stops. People just stop picking up the phone. And that was like a really interesting time. I had just lost all that weight and I was figuring out what's next. And you learn who's up for the ride, right? I mean, my best friend in the world, Anthony, has been involved in every company I've ever done. He used to give me $200. Like, I would overdraft my bank account to get into Manhattan on the train and like borrow $200 from him and then use that for the weekend to like take a girl out or do something. And I could have like asked my parents for it, but I don't know if you know, but like being almost 30 and worth, like, it's just there was only so much my ego and my self-esteem mm-hmm. could take. So I think in my journey, everyone needs like the person who just believes blindly in them.
Right. And that was your friend.
That was my friend, Anthony. Yeah. Wow, like man. When I win, he wins no matter what.
Yeah. That's,
yeah.
That's beautiful. You mentioned something before that you're, I guess, good at foreseeing things before they kind of take off. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about like your first dose of AI and then how you kind of got into the Verb space and really what Verb is all about.
Of course. So I don't know how to write any code. I have zero technical skills. I'm probably similar to my gym, the last person who should be owning and running an AI company. And for our first 4 years, I didn't actually tell anyone there was an AI in it at all, because I thought it was like a corny thing to say, like, oh, we got this AI and nobody actually knows what the fuck that is.
Right.
So I just never said it. And now it's the hottest thing in the world. And I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. We could benefit from this. Right. So a lot of the things in the way in which I ran my life were the way that I trained clients, which was like, pay attention to these small things and just do them well. And it'll get you where you want to be. And there's these three girls who I really credit with the core concept. And we were sitting at my gym on a Sunday and they weren't overweight, but they weren't in amazing shape, right? I would say that they were mildly uncomfortable in a bikini. That's how I describe it. And, you know, memory changes over time, right? But that's kind of how I tell myself it. And they're like, well, I don't understand. Like, how do you do these things? Like, you were rich and then poor and then, you know, successful again, and you were skinny and then fat and then skinny again. Like, you did blow every day for 5 years and now you don't, and you didn't have to go to AA. Like, how do you do these things? And I was like, well, to me, it's simple. Like, just pick whatever your thing is, and every decision for that thing is the only thing you think about for the next 60 days. That's it. You want to lose 10 pounds? No problem. Every decision you make for the next 60 days, will this help me lose 10 pounds? If the answer is no, you don't do it. No wavering.
That's it.
Zero. 60 days. It's going to go by anyway. You could either be closer to that.
Why 60? Right? Because you hear like it takes 21 days to build a habit. You hear 75 hard challenge. So where'd you come up with the 60?
So I looked at it this way. Anyone could do anything for like 2 or 3 weeks, right? And most real changes need a little bit longer than 30 days. And it doesn't need to be losing weight. It could be just like running, right? Like you were talking about running, right? It's just,
I'm still winded, Vin.
Yeah, anyone could like dig through running for 2 weeks.
Yep.
But you might not notice the change in your lung capacity or how you feel until probably like a month or so. And what I have found is longer than 60 days, people's real lives, they feel like they're missing out. So I usually say like 60 to 90, but I told these girls 60, pick whatever you want for 60 days.
And now this is in regards to their weight loss?
Their weight, yeah. Gotcha. So like they were doing 2-a-days. They were like coming and rowing in the morning and taking class at night. Like they just weren't changing. And I was like, you guys are wasting your money here. You're like, you're actually wasting your money. There's better ways to spend your money and your time. You don't need to come 2-a-days. Like there's ways to do this. And they looked at me and they were like, okay. And like we kind of talked a little bit deeper about their each individual things. And then I went home that day and I was like, man, this is, maybe that is like the message that I have to give, is like, this is how I attack goals. how do I share? Like, I just changed these three girls' lives. Like, how can I do that for everyone? And I was like, all right, look, I'll write a book. Like, how hard could it be to write a book? Like, and I'll tell this story. And the concept of the book was, I would do nothing for 1 year, which is 1% of your life. It's actually like 340 days is 1% of your life. If you live to 80, I was like, all right, I'll round it up to a year. I'll do nothing for 1 year.
Sit on the couch and do nothing.
If it didn't revolve around my career.
Oh, okay.
So I took what I gave them and I said, how do I tell this the most extreme way possible that people would actually want to read it?
Right.
Said, so, okay, if it didn't revolve around my career, I would not do it for one whole year. And every day I would write a little journal entry and I would record a little video on the things that I did. And I would put that into a book. And then I invited a few people and I said, hey, I'm doing this thing. I want you to be a chapter. Pick a goal. I'm not your coach. I'm not your doctor. I'm not your therapist. Just send me a video every day on what you do or don't do towards your goal. And you've got 60 days to get there. And I was like, this is going to be an amazing book. Those five people grew to like 400 or 500. And I was collecting hours and hours of video logs a day on like people's most intimate, like the most intimate things I've ever heard people sharing, affairs and drug use and hating their life and wanting to leave their careers, just real raw intimate stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, there's something interesting happening here. This is going to be an awesome book. One of those people ended up selling their company and he's like, I think you have a company here. I think you could like build a new company. And I'm like, nah, man, his name's Chris. He's one of my biggest mentors. Massive supporter of mine as well. He's like, I really think you have a business here. I was like, nah, I'm going to write a book. I'll be on Oprah. It'll be amazing. And he's like, no, I really do. And we went back and forth a little bit. And I'm like, all right, fuck it. Like, let's go down this like private accountability space. And we saw that no one was really doing it well. And the original concept, like I wanted to build this digital version of yourself that never forgets and could interact back with you. Right. So if you talk about hating your job every day for 8 months, at the end of the year, like your digital self should be like, hey man, are you like, you literally talked about hating work 85% of the past year. You should probably get a new job. And that was the real concept of what the business was going to become. Again, I didn't know anything about coding. I didn't know about artificial intelligence at the time. Like I found a little agency that would build it for me. And for anyone who wants to start a technology company, if you don't know how to write code, you don't get to really trade time for product. You only really get to trade money for product or equity for product.
Yeah.
Right. Like, because I can't home and write code at night. I've got to be like, hey, Dave, like go write this fucking code for me and send me a thing. So I started working with an agency out of New Haven. They helped me spin up an MVP, which we threw in the app store and we had a couple thousand users and there was some interesting stuff going on. And then I met my co-founder and CTO now, who fortunately for me has been writing artificial intelligence and machine learning code for like 15 years. And he's like, yeah, like you don't have enough money to do this on video. Nobody's paying attention to text. Let's go to text messaging. And I was like, bro, text is so corny. He's like, yeah, I know, that's why. He's like, we can do something and we'll see if it works. And by the time we go to market, it'll be something that doesn't exist. So he kind of spun up a really janky version of a platform that I could send texts on a mobile app and you would get it as a text message, a 10-digit phone number. You would get text messages. And he's like, just go do what you do now. Just go do the same thing you do with all these clients. And I manually did like 2 or 3 million text messages.
Just like motivation.
Everything. Like, how'd you sleep last night? You answer. Cool. Why'd you sleep 3 hours instead of 7 hours?
But now AI is getting back to you?
No. In this first version, I was literally doing millions of messages all day, every day.
Oh my God.
Yeah. All day. How's your food? Are you going to dinner? Send me
your menu. And this is to now gain like...
He was just, my CTO was like, just do this.
Get reps in.
And I'll see what we can come, what can come.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I did a couple million messages and he's like, all right, awesome. Like I figured out our data set, what we want to measure.
Gotcha. That was to build the
how data. how we want to do this, how we can scale this conversation. And it was really kind of janky, right? It was like this thing. And our first product would automate, ask you how you slept, how's your food, how's your water, how was your workout? And how's your stress? Which, if you pay attention to all five things, you'll change your life. Nobody actually wants to. And again, this is all built off how I would do it. So yeah. I still get 20 or 30 messages a day from my platform. Get up, you know, get your day started.
Yep.
Shut your phone off. How's your food? You know, did you call your mom? Like I run my life with the product that I built, but I didn't know the rest of the world couldn't. Like, started doing some testing, and people were like, measuring these five things every day is really overwhelming. And I'm like, okay, so I didn't know that, right? So let's scale it back. So that was our first product. And then as time progressed, you know, we really started being a very specific wellness platform for habits. And we started to notice that, like, people were losing weight without really needing to do anything different. Like, you just have someone pay attention to water for 2 months, like, they'll lose weight.
Expand on the water piece. Why the water? And then what about water specifically? Like, are we talking like just sink drink and accumulating, you know, a gallon a day? Okay. Or is there like specifics that, you know, because there's so many studies out there with the pH levels and then the electrolytes. I specifically do lemon and salt in my water every morning. But then there's also studies about how Himalayan salt now has heavy metals in it. Right. So they're talking more about the Celtic salt.
Okay.
Right. So, like, what are you saying about the water specifically? And this is just for my own knowledge here.
Once I gave up drinking alcohol, I didn't consume anything except water and coffee. That was the only things that I drank. And you always hear the saying, right? Especially if you're ever in bodybuilding circles and, you know, weight loss circles, are like, drink a gallon of water a day and you'll lose weight. And I think there's a couple fold to that. One is that, like, if you drink a gallon of water a day, you're kind of full all day, right? Like, so I think that there's a little bit of like placebo and psychology around that. If you're, if you're focusing on drinking water, you're not going to eat as much by default. And that's like the non-science of it. Right. And then there's the idea around that we're so water-based that hydration adds, it keeps your body moving. I mean, like, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is drink 40 ounces because, like, it kind of helps me wake up.
Me too, yep.
So it was like, okay, if people just drank more water, they'd be more, be healthier. That was really the concept. Okay. And then, you know, something we didn't learn during COVID, we ran, you know, some testing with a few hundred thousand people. About 30% of the people that were using our platform drank zero water a day.
What?
And not like kind of zero, but coffee, like, soda all day, zero glasses of water a day, which told me that the way that I was approaching this as a product was completely wrong in the first place. Because, like, to me, the idea of drinking no water is insane.
Sounds crazy. Yeah, yeah.
So it really highlighted that, generally speaking, our population is more unhealthy than they are healthy. So again, it was like these simple things of, like, if you just drank more water than you do today, it will have better benefits for you than it doesn't.
Gotcha.
And that was really, that's the whole concept. And if, you know, you pay attention to your stress, and if you're stressed every day, you might start changing the way you think about your day. Mm-hmm. And that aha moment happens for people differently on our platform. They're like, oh, I notice on my rest days, I overeat every time I take a rest day, which is something that we all know if we're doing it, but you don't really know it until you see it every day. So it's really a simple product. And then our AI has just, it is so specific to wellness interactions that it far supersedes really anything out there at the moment. And some of these large language models and the ChatGPTs, like, they're so vast that they can't get that specific. And because our data sets were built with a human to human communication, it is even more case by case
realistic, right?
Realistic. Yeah. It's really unique.
How does somebody get Verb itself? Like, where do you download it?
Is it App Store? It's a no app experience, which is the other thing. I think people are done with apps.
So how do you get it?
So we are an enterprise business, which means we typically interface with brands like 24 Hour Fitness or big box brands or CrossFit gyms, or, you know, a personal trainer is using it. So you, as like an individual, your gym has to be using it.
Gotcha. Okay.
In some sense, you know, we still have people reach out and they're like, oh, man, I'd really love a coach. And
I'm just going to text you from now on.
I really want a coach. Who can I get paired with? And I'll try to find someone why not? And we have, you know, hundreds of personal trainers and hundreds of gyms using us around the country, and some big box brands, some influencer brands use us for their, you know, their communication. It's really unique how much the communication aspect of someone's wellness journey is imperative to their success.
This episode is sponsored by Light Crafters, your professional Christmas light installers. Are you tired of spending countless hours untangling Christmas lights, climbing ladders, and struggling to create that perfect holiday ambiance? Look no further. LightCrafters is here to transform your home into a winter wonderland with their professional Christmas light installation services. At LightCrafters, they understand the importance of creating a magical atmosphere during the holiday season. Their team of skilled and experienced installers are dedicated to bringing your vision to life, ensuring that your home stands out as the epitome of festive cheer. Why choose LightCrafters? Here's what sets them apart. Expertise. Their team consists of highly trained professionals who have mastered the art of Christmas light installation. With years of experience under their belts, they know the best techniques and have an eye for detail, guaranteeing a flawless display every time. Customization. They believe that every home is unique, and your Christmas light display should reflect your personal style. Their designers will work closely with you to understand your preferences and create a customized plan that perfectly complements your home's architecture and landscape. A hassle-free experience. Say goodbye to the stress and frustration of dealing with tangled lights and malfunctioning bulbs. LightCrafters takes care of everything, from design and installation to maintenance and takedown. Sit back, relax, and let them handle the hard work while you enjoy the magic of the season. This Christmas, let LightCrafters be your go-to professional Christmas light installers. Contact them today to schedule a consultation and let the team bring your holiday dreams to life. You can find them on Instagram at LightCraftersNY. Don't forget to tell them that you're a friend of the No Snooze podcast. Now, back to the Epi. All right, I have another twofold question for you.
Yep.
What's the biggest risk that you've taken that has worked out for you? And then the biggest risk that you've taken that has not worked out for you?
So after I lost all my money, I was doing some consulting work for a company called Aon Insurance. They do disaster reinsurance and things like, it's like really
like flood and
yeah. Like, yeah. And I worked on the World Trade Center, Sandy insurance claim.
Oh wow.
Right. And I was like sitting in a conference room, crunching numbers, and yep. I was using it to pay for my lawsuits at the time. And so the reason I bring that up is I was sitting on a subway train in New York, and this is like in 2010, maybe ish. And I just overheard these two kids talking about Bitcoin. Right. And I was just listening to them talk, and I didn't ask them anything because I didn't have any money anyway.
And this is 2010.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, that's a thing, whatever that is. And I was like, I fucking love gambling. I love playing poker, right? Like, I'm like, this sounds like something. Yeah, I'm already broke. It doesn't matter. Lane.
Let's do it.
So what I used to do was, and it's actually kind of, it's a twofold part to this, and we'll talk more about the thing that I think was the biggest failure for me. So I used to, when I got paid on Friday, I would take like $80 or $100, which was all I could afford. And at the time you could only buy crypto. You had to like MoneyGram it, which if you don't know what MoneyGram is, it's like the red phone in like a Walmart or a Rite Aid. You have to like MoneyGram it to Japan. And then it like, they got it and you got an email like 4 days later. And then it like gave you access to buying it. And so I used to MoneyGram like $80 to Japan, and then I would buy this thing. And it was on, there was like only four places you could buy it. And at the time, you could like watch your trade happen. So few people were buying it that like, if I bought it, I could like watch my trade go off. And from my experience on Wall Street, I was like, oh, I could like see my trade move the
direct
price
impact, right?
From like $80 to $80.50 or whatever it was. So, I started like trading it myself. I would like trade with myself and like build the price run up. And then I would like sell it when someone else would notice that a price was running up. And so it was like $80 to like $200, and then it would crash to $60. And so I was like trading it on this website, and I was like making extra money. I kept pulling out because I was broke. So I was like, fuck, I'll pull it out. Right. And then one day in like 2012, maybe, I don't know, the website, I went to sign on, and it was all in Japanese, right? And that was like the first real hack. And for anyone who knows crypto, it's like the Mt. Gox exchange, and it turned into a 10-year bankruptcy, and there's some rehabilitation. So people are getting some of their coins back. So the reason I bring that up is this. I think that was probably my biggest risk that paid off, because I was exposed to crypto in 2009, 2010.
It's crazy.
And through the course of my life, I had my ups and downs with it where like I lost a lot of money when that site went down. So then I ignored it for a couple of years and I was like, fuck this thing. It was a scam. I made a bunch of, I made like $5,000-$10,000. Cool. From $80. Awesome. Right. I paid some of my lawyer fees. I was able to like, you know, be a normal person again. I could pay my cell phone. And then over the course of the past, you know, 14, 15 years, I've been able to sit in rooms with some of the biggest hedge funds in the country talking about like trades in 2019 and like advising on that type of stuff. So it's put me in other rooms that I had no business being in. And then I've also been able to make a lot of money on it because it's always the same, right? Like I believe this bull run will be the last big bull
like
run.
Like right now that we're
yeah,
in right now. I just saw that, yesterday. I think it was over 41,000.
Yeah.
The time,
and
right?
I think we'll probably see a really big bull run and then it might stabilize. And then over the course of our life, it'll keep climbing. I support a lot of what crypto has done. I do believe like Bitcoin's going to be $1 million in our lifetime, right? For one, whether that happens or not, I've been fortunate that I've been able to do different things with it. So I think that that's been a really big risk because no one even knew what it was. I didn't even tell anyone I was doing it. Right. I was like, I'm embarrassed. I'm broke and I'm sending money to Japan.
With a red phone.
And a thing. It was super weird. So I would say that that was like the risk that has led me to where I am today.
Yep.
Right. And I think people look at risk the wrong way. They only look at it as like how I made money from it. And every business that I've built and every risk that I've taken has actually made me who I am with pieces of knowledge, with personality traits that allow me to do the things that I do today. So I would say that that decision to do something completely unknown with no friends involved has probably yielded the most, both financially and like knowledge wise. Mm-hmm. The biggest risk that I ever took that worked out horribly for me. It'd be really easy to say my nightclubs because it drove me to bankruptcy. And I think that would be like a really cop out. Let me just give that some thought.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And because if I don't choose like losing $20 million in like value
right.
as my biggest risk that worked bad, I want to make sure that I give it some real thought.
Yeah, I got asked a question on a podcast yesterday. I was on the No Quit Living podcast, and he asked me if I wanted to sit down with five people dead or alive, you know, who would the five people be? And I was stumped. I mean, I sat there for like, you know, a minute of silence to really strategically think about this question. And my answer, by the way, I'll give it to you, was my grandfather, my mother, who's been sober 5 years, Eminem, Dr. Martin Luther King, and Michael Jordan. That was my five. But I was so stumped in that moment. You know, so I get it. And I gave you some time to think here, Vin. So hopefully that gave you enough time.
I'm gonna try to say something that adds more value, I think, to your listeners than just me just picking some random shit that made me lose money or friends or, you know, like I lost all my friends when I had my nightclubs because I really, my nightclubs were too cool for me to be in. So forget about bringing a bunch of Italians from Westchester, right? So I used to be like, guys, you can't fucking come to my nightclub. So when I lost all my money, not only did all my hospitality relationships die, all my, my actual friends that I've had for most of my life didn't talk to me either.
Wow.
So that took years to rebuild. I would say that's up there.
Yeah.
So I speak at universities a lot and I try to give young kids good advice. And I think the idea of starting companies now is like really cool and it's like in, and I don't think people realize how hard it actually is. And if I could go back in time, I think there's two things that I might do with the hindsight that I have now. One of them would be probably to join the military. I think that is something that I would have liked to have experienced.
Structure, discipline, consistency,
just the whole
all that
thing. I think that it builds, you know, a lot of the people that I've met that I've served have just a different way about them that is lost to a lot of the world at the moment. And that's something that, you know, I could never go back at 39. Like I can't go join the military. And I don't know if I would now anyway. So I think that that's something that I probably would have been good at. And that's one thing. The other thing is I learned a lot in college. I don't think that I learned a lot of school in college. Right. I was an okay student until I started taking business classes. Like, you know, I got like a D in sort of philosophy, right? Because like, right. Who gave a shit?
Yeah.
But that's how I thought about it. And when I talk to younger kids and they always ask for advice, they're like, I want to start a new company in this. And I think people always think that you're just making hundreds of thousands of dollars running companies. And anyone who works for me knows that like I'm definitely the least paid person in my businesses by far.
The least paid?
Least paid by far.
Why is that? By choice or?
By choice, but also like when I sell, I want to come with the dump truck and I want to, that, and that's what I say to people. I say to my clients and my business partners and my employees, I said like, you need to make this much money. Like that's four times what I make as a salary. And they're like, okay, well, why? And I said, well, cause when we sell, like I get to come with the dump truck and they get to pour the money into that. Right. So the advice that I try to give younger kids is I say, look, at 18 years old, I would get a civil service job in whatever field that interests you. And then I'd pay my way through college. And that does two things. The first thing, well, besides, I don't believe in student loans whatsoever, right? I was fortunate that I didn't have them. So thank you, mom and dad, on that one. Like, bravo. But get a civil service job when you're 18. Garbage, fire, it doesn't matter. I don't care what it is. It does something. It means that your minimum life will always be that.
Stable.
And people do not know how important that is. The second thing, by paying your way through college, it teaches you the actual value of money and what it means to take your money and spend it on a thing that might have a return and might not. And then, so now I'm 39. If I was 18 and I went and got, let's say, a sanitation job for 20 years, I'd be retired. I'd have my pension. I'd have my health insurance. I'd have, you know, that minimum life, right?
It's always met.
It's there. And I think that people discredit that. I think people discredit what a good hard day's work can do for you. And again, this isn't a huge regret of mine or a risk that I took, but I think that looking back, there's so much value in what that would have. I mean, I fucked around in my 20s anyway. Like I was successful and made money and lost money, but like most people don't realize you waste your 20s experimenting. So you might as well do something that you know, might be full time. It might be a couple days a week, whatever, but you could also experiment on the side. Like there's so many ways to slice that life that I think gives people freedom on the back half of their life when they actually have their shit together.
Wow. So you know that I've spoke to many successful people in my life and I've never heard that answer before, ever. And I don't know if you know, but I, you know, I'm a civil servant as well.
I do.
And CV too, he's been in 20 years. Right, TV? 20 years. I'm about 13 now. You know, and I think it's the best. We talk about it all the time. Like, you know, it gets frustrating at times, but it allows you the stability to learn hard work, commitment, right? Understanding how to work in a government environment. We're specifically Department of Community Resources, so we're a little bit more rewarding of a career than most, I would say, in my personal opinion. But that's really good to hear, man. I've never heard it. I almost hear the opposite, right? Everybody like shies away from that, man. So that's great to hear.
You know, think about it this way. We'll just use no snooze as the example. I'm just going to use some made up numbers so you guys can listen. Let's just say, in his current role, his base salary, I'm just going to make it up, is 80 grand a year.
And that means, as the CEO of the podcast?
No. What's your civil service job?
I'm a deputy commissioner.
Deputy commissioner. Okay. So let's just say he makes $80,000 a year and he gets his health insurance. Like just using that as base. And no snooze. He's launched. He's done 160 plus episodes. He's invested 100 grand in cash into that. And tomorrow it implodes and it just goes away. The money you might make from ads or whatever is also gone. If he does that, he has also taken the same risk that I might have. The only difference is that he could actually still pay for his bills and it doesn't drive him into the ground and he doesn't lose his house. Whereas if I were to put balls to the wall into a podcast and lose all the money I had, I'm back at zero. Maybe that makes me more resilient. Maybe it doesn't. But like, I think people really discredit how much, one, having to answer to somebody you learn from it, absolutely. Right? When I meet people who are like, I want to run my own company because I don't know how to answer anyone, like, that doesn't mean you should run your own company. It just means you have literally no idea how to, right. how to take an order or to do a task, right? And I take orders all the time. Like, I'm the boss of my companies, but my employees tell me what they're doing for the thing that they're paid to do.
Right.
So I think there's so much value in that. And again, people think at 20 years old, they're an adult. And yeah, in a time, 100 years ago, fine, you were an adult when you were 20. But like, right. we're still kids now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen a 20-year-old. They're like children, yeah. right? So to get a job that has structure and has pay and gives you stability and then lets you have the side gig or work at a deli and see if you like it or start a company on the side or detail cars or whatever the fuck it is that gets you excited yeah. and see if you could actually make money, you're taking the same level of risk on that side of it. But what's actually happening is you're hedging your life for long-term happiness. For me, when I lose, it sets my life back a couple of years.
Right, right.
So like I've had all these lives, but in all those lives that you did in my introduction, I lose time. I lose relationships. I lose the potential to start a family in my 20s. Like there were things that set me back because I, you know, there's a thing called charging off your bank account. When you're so broke, they just like send you a bill and shut your bank account off. They were like, oh, you don't have a bank account anymore. You owe us $1,000.
Wow.
You're in collections. You no longer have a bank account. I'm like, oh, I'm like the work. I'm like so broke. I actually owe the bank. Right. Money. So I'm like, I can't be a good partner. I can't give stability. I can't do the one thing that I'm supposed to do, which is like provide. Protect. Right. So for me in doing these things, I lose time. I trade time and I trade like pieces of my life for that experience. Whereas I think someone who went that route at an 18, you like can still do those same levels of risk, but I think it allows you to stay one foot in front of the other.
Phenomenal stuff, man.
So that's yeah, my plug for
sure.
Go get a job in the local community.
Yeah, yeah. A topic that's talked about a lot is surrounding yourself with like-minded people and running in, you know, some pretty elite circles. You've actually done that though. So I want to hear from you, like, how has, you know, running with, you know, you mentioned Brian before and your other business partner who you've been friends with for years versus you when you kind of cut off your friends, right? How real is that? And I guess talk to me a little bit about the impact that, you know, your circle specifically have either contributed or been a detriment, you know, depending on where you were
yeah.
in the journey.
So I'll start with the non-drinking because I think it's a really important thing. I think it's like now it's becoming more acceptable to choose to not consume alcohol. A couple of things happened when I stopped drinking. I immediately lost certain friends that did drink. And it might have been either we didn't really have anything in common except being out and drinking, or it made them feel a certain way about themselves that then projected onto me and that unwound our relationship. The reason I bring that up is, excuse me, once I stopped drinking, I just happened to find that the type of person that resonated with that for me at that time in my life was a few notches up than what I had normally been around.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that you're a good person if you don't drink, and I'm not saying you're a bad person if you do. I'm just saying that at that time, I was like, oh, by being around people who also don't drink and want to go do an act, go for a hike and a walk in a meeting instead of going to a bar or meet me for coffee, I just found at that time in my life, they were a level up. So I was like, oh, there's a way that I could kind of game this of being in a room that I'm not supposed to be in and being yep. around good people. So that's number one. Number two, when you look at someone, look, Brian is one of the most unique people I've ever met. He just always wants to be better. And it's sometimes fucking annoying, right? I've run with him before and like, I'm like, bro, we got to slow. I'm dying. I'm literally dying right now. But like, you don't want to say that because someone's also doing that. So I'm like, well, if he's, I could fucking do that too. Right. So it forces you to level up when you're around people who want to be better. And what I have found, and this was like a weird conundrum for a while, I'm like, oh, I'm always supposed to be like the least important or stupidest person in the room. But if I'm always doing that, then how does someone less important and stupider than me get in a room with me? But what I have found is people who are generally positive, always pushing the envelope, they enjoy like bringing in people who have that same hunger.
Right.
And it's far less about the relationships that get opened or the business that can get done. And it's far more about seeing that other people have a mentality that is more extreme in a positive way than yours. Right. So that's been a big piece of it. And like my best friend, Anthony, look, he works at a huge investment bank. He stayed on Wall Street. We both went on Wall Street at the same time. He stayed, which was able to give me that help when I needed it. But he's just been my biggest supporter. Like when I'm like, bro, I might fucking cash it in and just be done, bro. And he's like, what do you mean?
Can't do that.
Can't do that. That is, and we had a dear, dear friend of ours. She passed away a number of years ago. We had a company together doing like this stuff. We did printing and stickers and we had it for 10 years and we had a 60,000 square foot facility in Bridgeport running 500 e-stores for brands. And she was the first person I've ever come across that was just my supporter.
Gotcha.
Like,
yep.
I did not really realize it until she was gone that like, that was a person who was just like, I believe in what
you, yep.
And I want to be involved. Like I seeded her company when she left hers and that's how we became partners. And so those types of people around you, are probably the most important in this like entrepreneurial journey or even in life. Right. And deep down, everyone knows the people who are not rooting. Like, you know someone right. who's not actually rooting for you. And it's hard to, like, break up with a friend, right? It's really, really difficult. And I have found that as long as I try my best to act well-intentioned in relationships, that people also want to be around me, right? I'm fortunate at the moment that, like, I don't have any presence publicly. So like no one's using me for that. And I see that a lot with friends of mine that like you see that people want to use that like clout to try to make themselves look like they have clout. And unless you actually know me and know that some of the things I've done, like you don't know that I could add any value. And that's okay sometimes too, right? But having a circle that actually wants you to win and like, people are like, oh, don't do business with your friends. Like, I love fucking doing business with my friends. I absolutely love. There's no better feeling than making money with someone you care about. And it hurts when you don't. I mean, Anthony and I have lost money together. We've had hard conversations. Our friendship has been tried many, many times. But like when we do something that we make money on, it's like there's no fucking better feeling on the planet than winning with people you care about. But it takes a lot. It takes a lot of losing. And I completely disagree with the idea of like, don't do business with your friends. Mm. It's like, for me, it's one of the biggest things that I think sets people in the wrong way because like, okay, so we just met, right?
Yep.
And let's say over the next year, we become really good friends. Just like, you know, talk all the time, huge respect for each other. You know, I help you with guests, you help me with business. And we really build this amazing relationship. And then let's say 2-3 years from now, we have this amazing friendship and two scenarios happen. The first one, we're out and something happens that like is, let's say, below board. I want to be next to someone that I value, that I care for, and that I know cares for me because two or three people who have that, I'll judge you the same way I'm going to judge myself. I was a big fighter growing up. You learn quick when somebody wants you to win and someone cares about you and you're in a fight out in public because it's scary.
Right.
So you learn quickly who's with you. And that same concept in starting businesses like, hey man, like I want to start this business and I know that you have value to me and I have value to you. And then we win and I'm like, fuck bro, like that was such an amazing relationship to build for 3 years. And then we just won together.
It makes it even better.
I don't know how to explain how amazing it is to like look at your friends and your circle because it's going to get hard. So when it gets hard and money's tight and you got to do a capital call and you got to lay people off and the landlord wants to evict you or you can't find clients and your people in your room with you are your people, you're like, yo, we could fucking take over the world. And that doesn't need to be big, like 3-4 people that are like, yo, we're in this.
And locked into
it. We're in this. And this is how if we lose, this is what losing looks like. Mm. That's the thing people don't talk about. They don't talk about what losing looks like. Like, hey, yo, you want to start a podcast together? Cool. they always talk about what do we do right. when there's money. No one's really like, okay, if we lose, what does this actually do to us? Yep. How do we do it so it doesn't affect the friendship, and how do we do it to learn from it? So having a circle that really cares, and you find that, like, I think being around people who have lost, mm-hmm. it could be lost family members, it could be lost
adversity,
real adversity. It's almost like a mandatory thing for me, because, like, you have to know what it feels like. I meet founders all the time that are raising money, that have never done anything. And I'm just like, people love first time founders. Yeah. They're like, bro, I want to back first time founders. And I'm like, I want a dude who's unwound a 100-person company before
right.
and looked at 100 people and been like, yo, I can't pay you anymore.
Cause they understand.
They understand. They know how to, like,
resilience.
So,
to get there.
So to wrap up the circle, it's like, I think people discredit how important having a quality circle. Right. And it might just be one person. For a long time, I only had one person.
Mm-hmm.
Could just be one, and it takes time. And you kind of have to lose together, and you find something small.
Yeah.
Like, let's do this thing for like $1,000. Let's each put $500 in and like just see what happens mm-hmm. and lose some money together and figure out what that feels like.
So I don't know, and I'm going to switch back now to the sobriety journey. You've been sober 13 years now, I believe?
Yeah, 2011.
Yeah, so.
Can I just clarify before you ask your question? I'm sober. I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I don't smoke. In the course of the past 13 years, I've probably consumed alcohol 5 times.
Okay. Gotcha, okay.
I am sober. Yep. I don't fall off the wagon. I don't count the days.
Yep.
Right. I have a different relationship with what I believe sobriety is.
Right, right.
And I talk a lot about that. So I just want to highlight that so you understand.
Because sure. Addiction just hits close to me. You know, my mom just reached 5 years of sobriety. It's been the most beautiful, humbling, inspiring journey ever. Over the past, I don't know, 6-7 years, I've been leaning into my relationship with a higher power. Mm-hmm. And I speak about it very frequently, openly, but I'm still struggling with the social, I guess, dynamic of like drinking. You know, and again, this is very personal to me right now, but again, my podcast, I kind of do what I want to do, right? So sorry, guys.
No, I love it.
So I'm curious though, like, was there a time that you battled? Cause there are nights that I can have 2 drinks and I enjoy myself and I'm like, oh, I'm a little tired. I'm gonna go to sleep. And then there's nights that, like, I'm like 2 drinks in, I'm like, well, let's rip 2 shots. And you know, before you know it, it's 2:00 in the morning and you know, now you're at the casino and you're having a good time.
Yep.
Now my impact is a little bit different because I have a 3-year-old daughter. So, you know, my Sunday might be shot and I feel terrible. And I'm like, oh God, like, you know, I'm praying, well, please forgive me for my sins, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I just don't, I guess I struggle with like, I can still have fun and not drink, but I don't know how to get there. But if I'm being honest, I do have this feeling that there's almost no value in the alcohol anymore, which for people who really know me, that sounds crazy because I'm the life of the party, but I'm pretty much the life of the party when I'm drinking.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Of course. So early on when I first gave up drinking, this was a trick that I used to do because I wasn't strong enough to go out and tell people that I don't drink because I didn't want to have the conversation. It makes people feel uncomfortable. And it's far less about you enjoying yourself sober and far more about what it creates, because like 2 drinks in, everyone's okay. 5 drinks in, people are like, bro, you're not fucking drinking. What the hell? What's this? What's that? So what I used to do is anywhere we would go, and I was lucky that they were still my clubs when I started this, all my bartenders kept a bottle of Ketel One with water in it.
Oh.
And that was my first way to navigate being out. And I'm like, look, you know, to Cindy or whoever was bartending or Monica, I'm like, just pour me water in the shot. Or when someone wants to make me a drink, use that, yeah. Right? And that was great because like you only have to feign not drinking for like 2 or 3 drinks because then no one actually gives a fuck.
Right, right. Because then you're like, I'll take a water.
Well, because then once everyone's drunk, nobody's really paying attention if you're still drinking. They only know from the beginning if you're not drinking. So that was the other thing I noticed. And then the other thing I noticed about being out is when someone started repeating their story, I knew I could leave when no one actually gave a shit either.
Ooh.
Once the story started to regurgitate, because they do, you don't notice it till you're out sober, right? once they're like, oh my God, I did this thing and I got into a fender bender yesterday, blah, blah, and you'd hear it again. I'm like, cool, I could exit stage left. And yeah. No one even cares that no one even needs me to say goodbye.
Right.
And what ends up happening is they'll stay out. And then the next day they're like, man, when did you leave? I don't remember you leaving. Fender and you're like, yeah, story. Bro, like I dipped out. I was just shot. I was whatever. Yeah, and then they're like, cool, bro, no problem. Right. So
let's do it again soon.
That's how I started navigating that. Once I opened the gym, I used to like sleep there at night. My life became that. And I would get up at 3:30 in the morning. So like drinking just wasn't on the list of important things for me. It just what couldn't happen. And right around the time that I was opening the gym, I was like, man, everyone always asks me like, what makes you happy? What makes you happy? What makes you happy? Like, what do you like to do? And I'm like, wait, what I like to do and what makes me happy aren't the same thing. So those lists aren't the same. So I made a list of like what I things that I do that I smile when I'm doing.
Things that you do when
you smile. So let me give you an example, right? Like I'm an avid snowboarder. I get immense joy from that. Or actually reading. It's really hard. I go through like waves, but like reading, watching, going to the movies. It's like, fuck, bro. It's like one of my most favorite things to do.
Really?
So I made a list of things that I actually smile when I do. And if it wasn't on that list, I never did. I just was like, yo, no. I'm just not doing it anymore.
And this relates back to, I guess, the beginning of the episode where you kind of just said, like, you can lock in and you can do that. Do you think that's a gift of yours?
I think it's probably tied to some trauma somewhere in my life that I don't know about that I'm able to just
great
like,
skill, man.
Yeah, I don't. And maybe I turned it to a positive thing.
Yeah,
and,
for sure.
You know, talking about the social aspect of drinking and how you attack that. I don't watch sports anymore. I went to 100 Yankee games the last year the stadium was open, the old one, right? Like, I mean, I watched sports my whole life. Like celebrities came to my nightclubs and athletes. And so I was involved in that. But then I started to notice as I aged that all my buddies were like gambling on sports. And I'm like, well, I don't fucking gamble on sports. So what am I watching it for? If they're only watching it for that. And then I found that then the second piece of that was like, everyone was drinking on Sunday and everyone was partying on Sunday for football. The reason I bring that up is a buddy of mine, maybe it's like the Giants or Cowboys, right? They're a big rivalry, right?
Yes, so yes, man.
I think they were like, yo, we're doing a 1 o'clock Giants Cowboys game at my house. We're getting wings and everyone's going to be smoking and hanging out and whatever. I said, yo, Bobby, like, you know, I don't drink and I don't smoke and I don't do Sunday fun days because Monday's a big day. Like, he's like, come on, bro. You never come hang out. I said, okay, how's this sound? I said, we're friends, right? I said, because yeah. So we've known each other 30 years. Yeah. Okay, friendship's two ways. Because it is. I said, okay, I'm going to come tomorrow. I'm going to hang out. I'm going to eat wings. I won't even complain. I'm going to enjoy the whole day. And next weekend, I want to do something that I want to do. And I'd like to invite you to it. And he's like, okay, well, what's that? And I'm like, I don't know. Let's go for a hike. And he's like, bro, why would I fucking do that on a Sunday when there's a football game on? And I said, that's not how friends operate. I said, so I'm just going to pass.
That's deep.
Right?
Yeah.
Relationships are a two-way street. You've got to give value and extract value because what's the point otherwise? Otherwise, someone's just taking.
Right.
So I was like, look, I'll come do what you want to do that I don't want to do for the sanctity of our friendship. But then next week, I want to do a thing that I want to do and I want you to come with it and experience it with me.
Very fair.
And he was like, no, I don't want to do that. Let's do it after the football season. I said, that doesn't work for me. Right? So to touch on like the sobriety piece and the drinking piece, now it's been so long, people just, they just are like, cool.
They just know what it is.
And now it's okay to not drink, right? It's like, it's more and more people are not doing it. And I think we're reaching a time where other activities around business, around friendship, don't have to be happy hour anymore.
Right.
You know, like we've been taught that everything needs a drink. Mm-hmm. Oh, bro, it's after work. You want to get together and have a drink.
Drinks.
Yo, you want to come over and have a glass of wine. Hey, you want to like, you know, go to dinner and we'll drink and all these things. And changing that mindset that you're looking for the quality experience is what you want.
Right.
And that's what I've started to do.
Is there something to be said about, and again, personal experience for you, something that my mom and honestly, everybody who's living that sober lifestyle and whatever that version of sobriety means to you, the clarity and the vision
Of
life.
Everything changed. Everything changed for me. The way that I sleep. Look, okay, I'll be really, really private for a moment, right?
No one's listening.
If you drink, Think about how often you have sex sober without one drink in you. In your life, think about how often that happens. So when I stopped drinking, I was like, oh my God, I'm so self-conscious about being with my girlfriend who I lived with. I'm like, we used to do coke all night on it. Like you're just like, oh my God, I never even am intimate with my partner sober. So that learning how to be comfortable in your body with your partner who you love without drinking was wild to me.
Wow.
So the reason I bring that up is it took a while, but as I learned more about my own body, being intimate with a partner sober is amazing, but being sober with someone who isn't sober is horrifying. And that to me was really uncomfortable. So there's all these aspects of alcohol that like we've just been brainwashed to need. And, you know, everything, the way that my body works, fitness, the way that my brain works. I mean, it's all different. I think I just operate at a higher level because I don't drink. Because like alcohol is poison. You will die if you drink too much of it. It's like, so it doesn't matter what we think, or that's just the reality of it. And I'll give one more like psychology twist on how you might want to stop drinking. There's two ways. And I recently just did a little piece on this, but a glass of wine is like 190 calories. So like you do some basic math, you end up consuming 13 or 14 months worth of calories just in liquor in a 1 year period.
And 3,500 calories is a pound. So if you do the math.
And that's if everything's perfect. Right. So just on like the weight loss journey, a glass of wine a night might be the one thing that's actually destroying you
right.
over the course of a long period of time. The second one is this, is I don't think people realize how much money you spend when you drink. So just take a 1 month snapshot of your bank statement and you could look like you might be spending $200, $300, $500, $800, whatever it is. If you're going out to dinner, you know,
at least $100.
Right. You go out to dinner without any alcohol, it's like $40 for two people.
Right.
You go with alcohol, it might be $200.
Yep.
So I think those are two ways that I used to convince. I'm like, okay, I don't have any money. So it doesn't like,
that doesn't work.
It doesn't work. And I want to be skinny and I weigh all my food. So like, That's wasted sustenance for me. So those were two tricks early on that helped me stay that way. But once they were gone, once it was gone for me. I was like, yo, it's done.
It's done.
Done.
I'm working on it, man. I really. And it's funny, this episode, you know, we're in December now. And I had commented on your post saying that I'm so looking forward to dry January. And I really hope to, CV will tell you, I've been saying this for a while now, right? Right? Like on the podcast, it's been something that like, again, I don't think there's anything bad with drinking if you can, you know, if you can control it. And again, there's two types of Dave Regina's life, though. You know, like I can do the one and done, or I can do the, you know.
So I'm going to challenge you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Right. So when I lost my 100 pounds the second time, it was like April 7th, 2011. I gave up drinking and coke and smoking. And I did 30 days. I lost 30 pounds. And then that weekend, I did everything I could find. So I did 30 days. Fuck it. I'm going to get demolished. Drank, coke, smoked, the whole thing, all weekend, right? And then
was that
my
challenge?
So I was like, now let's see if I could do 60. And like, I wasn't beholden to the 60, but I was like, I did 30 and I had an amazing outcome. I just went and got fucking hammered. I feel horrible.
Was that a one day thing?
It was the weekend, Friday, Saturday, like we just got hammered, right? And on that Monday, I was like, cool, let's do 60 now. I did 30.
So you did 30, then you got banged up, and then you were on track to do 60.
So you want
to
do dry January. So like do dry January, and then when you complete dry January, don't go off the rails. Go out for a nice dinner, have some drinks. Saturday, maybe have, you know, whatever. Do a normal weekend to celebrate that. And it's not about being sober and being beholden to that 30 days. You're not losing those 30 days. Do that, enjoy your weekend, and then be like, all right, cool. Well, let's do it again. So that's how I became sober. Because once I did 60 days, I said, fuck it, let's do 90. Fuck it, let me do 180. I'm like, I'm at 180. I might as well just see how long I could go. Right. And then 2014, for New Year's, I didn't make a resolution. I said, okay, look, I'm pretty much sober. I don't drink that ever. I want to see if I could reintegrate alcohol into my life to be social.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll drink 20 days this year. That gives me one day a month and special occasions. I'll write them down. I still have it written down. I said, okay, I'm allowing myself to drink now. I'm pulling the reins off the strictness and say, I'll drink 20 days this year. That's like my birthday and whatever. And at the end of the year, I had drank 5 days. And I said, okay, it's no longer important to me at all. And that was really, for me, like the last time that like I really came across it. You know, here and there, bachelor party, I'll like enjoy myself. Or, you know, we took a team to Wadapalooza, which is a CrossFit competition, years ago. And all the people who work in my gym heard these stories of my previous life. And they're like, we want to like party with you. And I'm like, you don't.
Yeah, right.
I'm like, but you don't. Because like, you're talking about I used to have 40 drinks a night and then get up and do it again and do it again and do it again and go to work and all this stuff. So we went to Wadapalooza and I was with like 6 or 7 people, like athletes and maybe their spouses. And we were all in an Airbnb. I said, at the end of the competition, we'll drink. So we went to the liquor store and I think there was 8 of us. And we bought a bottle of Grey Goose and 2 bottles of wine. And they're like, this is good. I said, for who?
For who? For me?
Right. I said, for who is this good for? I thought we were going to drink. Like, I'd have a good time. And they're like, no, this is good. And I'm like, let's just get another bottle of Kettle just to be safe. So by like 10 o'clock, everyone was ready for bed. And I'm like, who wants to come back to the liquor store? Like, we're go. I never drink. We're going to do it. Yeah. Let's actually do it. And it was fine. Like, we drank a little bit longer and then that was it. And it wasn't like, you know, I had this huge fall off the wagon event, but I was like, oh, like even my life, I can put down, like if my concept of partying is already outside of the norm of like someone who's like, I'm drinking tonight. They have 3 glasses of wine or 4 glasses and they're good. And I'm like, well, it's like 2 bottles of Kettle at 10 o'clock. Like, we're just going. The night's just so getting going. So I think that there's ways, because like to me, 1 glass of wine means nothing. What's the point? Like, I don't get home and like, man, I'd love a good Chianti. Like, it makes no fucking sense to me. Right?
So funny.
So, yeah.
No, I love that, man. And I think that I'm going to take you up on that challenge. This episode is brought to you by Hudson Valley Teeth Whitening. Hudson Valley Teeth Whitening is an experienced teeth whitening salon where you can get up to 7 shades lighter with just a 60 or 90 minute session in a professional and relaxing setting. They offer the most superior product coupled with the highest quality of customer service available to get you instant results. Whether you have an important event to attend, such as a wedding, birthday, anniversary, interview, or you are just unhappy with the color of your teeth, this LED light technology helps whiten your teeth fast and easy. At Hudson Valley Teeth Whitening, they understand how important your smile is to you. And speaking from personal experience, you'll be guided by highly efficient staff in a relaxing environment to reach your desired shade. Let them know you're a friend of Dave's from the No Snooze podcast and connect with them at HudsonValleyTeethWhitening.com or on Instagram at HVTeethWhitening. Now, back to the epi.
All right, close us out with this. I kept you a little longer than I promised, but right. I got to tell you, man, I'm very grateful for your time. I know you're an extremely busy man, and you've shared so much with us today, and I appreciate the openness and the honesty and the vulnerability here. And I'm really excited to get to know you even further on a personal level. So I just want to tell you that. And also everything you've accomplished thus far, man. You're only 39, the experience of a 109-year-old over here. Truly, and I mean that. Talk to us and I guess close us out with this story because to me, for whatever reason, it resonates with so much more than just the actual pull up itself.
Yeah.
The journey of the pull up for you and what that meant to you kind of along the way here.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me. This has been an awesome conversation. The journey of a pull up. So pull-up is an interesting movement that highlights a lot of different things in a person. It highlights that you're generally in okay shape, that you can maneuver your own body weight against gravity, and that you're also strong enough to pull that amount of weight in a force against itself.
Right.
So when I was really fat, I couldn't do a pull-up. And like, they talk about gym intimidation and all these cool words now, but like being an overweight guy in your 20s and you can't do a pull-up, like there was no more embarrassing thing to me than going to the gym and trying to learn how to do a pull-up. So I was overweight and I couldn't do a pull-up. So I took like a big drill. I forget what it's called, like a hammerjack drill. And I drilled directly into my parents' foundation of the garage. And my dad owns a fence company. So I went and I took a 3/8 inch bar and I bent it, you know, 90 degree, 90 degree, 90 degree. And I jammed it into the wall in my garage. And I figured, well, I can't fucking do any pull-ups. I don't want to go and embarrass myself. This is a great place to figure that out. And I knew two things. I knew that I couldn't do a pull-up today. And that in order to do a pull-up, I had to get a little stronger and I had to lose some weight. No matter what you tell yourself, if you can't do a pull-up, you're probably a little bit overweight and you're not strong enough. So like those two things have to work in your favor. So I was like, okay, fuck it. This is a big step for me. And when I can start doing pull-ups again, I'll go back to a gym. And for like 6 months, I would like just stare at it and I would like hold it for 30 seconds, you know, and then get off. And then I would get on it and like, you do this thing where like, kind of like move your shoulders and nothing happens.
Scap.
Yeah.
And then pull like, scaps back.
That was like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And then I could get a little bend in my arm. And like, I think it maybe 6 or 7 months until I could like a little bend became, you know, this bend. And then this became this. And then I was jumping off the wall and doing it. And it was for me such a massive turning point in my health journey because I was like, okay, like I was fat and I couldn't do a pull-up. And now I'm skinny and I can do a pull-up. Now I just need to do two of those. Like once you could do one real, that's the easiest way to compound that to me. That was my thought process. And I'm like, okay, so now I'm not a complete joke of a man. Now I can like start like being in public to do fitness. And forget the fact that I like completely covered all the cars in my parents' garage in like cement dust, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I used to just stand in this garage under it and like I empathize with people who used to come to my gym and were like, I can't do a pull-up. And I'm like, I get it. Trust me when I tell you that I get it, because it is one of the single most clear ways to showcase that you take care of yourself or you don't.
Right.
And it was for me, it was, I got to be embarrassed alone and I got to be shameful alone and I got to hide that. I think there's strength in someone being involved in that journey. Obviously that's a company I built to like walk down your journey. But that to me was like every step I got closer to the bar meant that I was getting closer to the other side of the life that I was living.
Mm. It's a great story, man. Question. How many pull-ups can you do today?
Strict, probably, you know, 14 or 15, that's right? Like, I mean,
no,
and not the, you know, like real,
yep.
You know, I don't,
not kipping,
you know,
pull-ups.
Yeah, there's not kipping, yeah, and not the this one, right? Yep. You know, I think like full dead hang, maybe like 14 or 15.
No, it's awesome, man. But, you know, I really appreciate that journey, you know, and hearing it. It just is the perfect analogy, I think, of life, you know, and that could be anybody's journey, man. It could be a sobriety journey. It could be an addiction that you're overcoming. It could be a business that you're building. Really, really just a perfect ebb and flow of what I think life is all about. Yeah. So thank you for sharing the story. Vin, please let everybody know where they can find and connect with you.
You can find me on Instagram, Vincent Micelli, VincentMicelli. Thank you for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, awesome, man. Guys, we just want to say thank you. So whether you've listened to one or 166, we're very grateful for you. We hope you get on this little challenge with me. And Vin, you're doing Dry January, obviously. You're sober. Right, there you go. But I think the way you put that was awesome, man. And I think that's something that we can kind of circulate and get some momentum behind.
You know, maybe we'll do a whole thing with it. We'll launch it through Verb and maybe just like do accountability on Dry January with no snooze.
I love it.
How about that?
Let's lock it in. Guys, you can shop the latest merch at nosnoozeshop.com. And as always, until next time, stop snoozing.
Get up and get after it.
Vin, you are the most interesting man on the planet. I swear to God. Thank you guys for tuning in. That's another epi in the books. You can follow us on Instagram at nosnoozepodcast and leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, No Snooze. Shop the latest merch at nosnooshop.com. Come on.